narrow is because the only product that dongles have been used for is software, right? If you bought a CD and had to plug a dongle into the side of the stereo, you know, maybe people would have come to you and sought a dongle exemption for music too. But the fact is that because of the ease and the price of setting up a DRM authentication server scheme, they're using this for more than software. They're using this for all kinds of works. Anything digital, they're using it for. Which is why I feel that this more broad exemption is necessary.
Do either of you see any kind of problem having this cover those number of classes of works in the case of authentication servers?
Yeah, I mean, yes, we see that as a problem. That's one of the breadth of this is one of the concerns. I think the distinction with dongles, I think Mr. Segoyan referred to it, that the availability of alternatives is limited, not only because it's no that particular version that's for which the dongle is used is no longer supported, but because that's more generally used for very high-priced items. I mean, that was certainly the record in this proceeding, and therefore that's a different situation than here with the kinds of stores that we're talking about. I think the problem with Mr. Segoyan's proposed compromise is that he is not satisfied with any of the alternatives that were provided historically by these companies. He's complained in his submission that the ability to burn the music to an MP3 format or to some other format results in an inferior quality track than the one that you originally gained access to. Although there are obviously a lot of ways to get superior quality in most cases. He objects to taking 4 or 5 minutes to create a 60-minute audio CD. That's not fair. That's not an alternative from his perspective. So I think it would just send us down a rat hole of trying to figure out what is an acceptable alternative, and it seems like a fruitless task when you consider that, as I think he's conceded, the harm has not been visited upon anybody yet. There's no record that it's happened, and I think his speculations about the state of the economy. Let's just say it falls short of demonstrating that it is more likely than not that this will happen in the next 3 years and that no alternative will be provided. I do need to, you know, reserve the point that we made before that for the purposes of this proceeding, the fact that you might have to spend something in order to take advantage of the alternative is not a bar, is not something that gets him over the hump of demonstrating the likelihood of an impact of the prohibition on non-infringing use.
If I could quickly disagree, which is that there is one remedy that I am very happy with, and while I'm not too keen on people having poor quality CDs of their purchased works, I am very, very happy to take refunds for customers. If a service wants to provide a full refund to customers who've been suckered into using one of these stores, they don't need to do anything else. A refund is totally fine.
Leaving aside whether there's proof of any problem occurring, just in getting to your point, Steve, about this being different from the dongle exemption because of the expense of those programs compared to these individual works that may be available in other formats, isn't one of the issues involved here that in the case of these types of works that for which authentication may be needed at a later point, it can typically involve large quantities of works, which when you put those together actually are probably, could be the same amount. We're talking about the same amount of actual investment in these works as was at issue in the dongle situation.
It could involve large quantities of works, but the availability, I mean, the problem with the dongle is in some cases there wasn't any support at all. There's no ability to get back to the status quo, if you will. And that was, I think, the basis for the for the concern. But here, there's always going to be alternatives. Up till now, there have been alternatives that require little, if any, cost to the consumer. There might be circumstances in which there would be some cost to the consumer.
Well, can you explain that? I'm not sure I follow exactly. I know that there can be these works could be available in other forms for purchase, but and one of the considerations, I don't like to turn this into a dongle discussion, but one of the considerations that was made there was that the offer was given to some of the purchasers of those programs whose hardware locks malfunctioned or no longer operated, was that if they just repurchased the program, they could use it. They could get a new one. That seemed to be an insufficient remedy in that situation. So here, if someone has a large library of iTunes songs or any kind of a music library, an audiovisual library, and that authentication server fails, is it an adequate remedy to have to repurchase those works in order to be able to just listen to them again?
Well, I'd have to go back and look at the dongle exemption and the reasons that you granted it. My recollection is that the reasons that you granted it were that there was some evidence that there was simply no way other than circumvention in order for people to regain this functionality that they had before.
Well, I believe in some cases there was the opportunity to repurchase the program. So we can look at that, and maybe we'll address that in some kind of follow-up. Ben, did you have something that you wanted to just...
Sure. No, I was going to follow up on your comment about cable, and I just wanted to get clarification. What was the intent of that example, so I can just get it straight?
Oh, sorry. In terms of answering Rob's question about the likelihood of harm in the next 3 years, I was referring to the fact that we have a long history of, in at least one marketplace, of using authenticating servers. And so since there's no record evidence currently about unremedied harm to consumers, and we've got a long history by which to, you know, speculate whether or not there would be harm in the future, that, you know, the cable example is one to look to. The other point that I believe I made with respect to cable was more in answer to Mr. Seguin's kind of rebuttal comments to us, where he said he was, you know, not sure how cable was at all relevant here, since he was talking primarily about works to which a consumer expected to have permanent access. And in that instance, I was drawing a parallel to making a recording on your DVR, which, similarly to other services which are offered on terms of service, you know, as long as you're a customer or as long as the entity survives or you know, what have you, it seemed like a parallel worth looking to. So
let me ask you this as a follow-up to that DVR question. When Time Warner Cable was still part of Time Warner, and I, say, hypothetically subscribed to Home Box Office for the purpose of recording all the shows I want to see, but I wasn't home to see them, and my DVR is full, and then my set-top box crashes, what was the remedy that Time Warner would provide to me as a cable subscriber in case of that happens?
I would have to confirm with Time Warner Cable folks who are no longer part of the company, but I believe the remedy was that you were allowed to, you know, re-download content, but I'm not sure that I'd have to confirm. I know that that is a remedy that is often offered in other contexts, for instance, iTunes and other services that we license have the ability to allow a re-downloading of downloaded content if there's a hardware failure. But I honestly just, I don't know what the remedy was in the case of Time Warner Cable, but I'd be happy to check.
Chris, in terms of the discussion of one of the examples you had was Circuit City's DivX service, and that raises an interesting issue just in terms of what some consumers had purchased were they could purchase these discs for time limited periods or and watch a show and then could pay more to get that. Are you focusing your comments in terms of the people who just paid for complete access to the works contained on those discs?
So the question is basically, should people be able to circumvent the encryption on try until you buy and then unlocked works?
Right. So for the use limited discs, so they owned these discs, but they walked into this arrangement knowing that they were only going to be able to use it one time or for a limited period of time. Should they, because this authentication keeps them from using it more times than they had agreed to, is there any reason why that should not, why they should, even though they continue to have the disks after the servers go down, did they really lose anything?
Sorry, I'm still having trouble. So let me just clarify again. So you're talking not about consumers who paid an additional $15.99 to unlock the disc forever. You're just talking about the instance where they had the $3.99 play for 3 days. You know, are we discussing just those consumers? Is that right?
How should we handle those consumers?
That's a rental.
Okay.
If the server fails, you know, that 3 day period is over. So, you know, I don't really care about them.
Okay. So it's just the discs that were intended to be completely
just
unlocked.
Purchases.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then in response to some of the points that Steve made about what is actually going on in terms of what would have to be done in order to conduct research on these systems. Can you explain what to your understanding, what would have to
occur? Sure, and thank you for bringing that up, because I forgot to address that point before. I'm glad that I'm going to get a chance to do this. So, you know, I have multiple hats, right? So I care about copyright law and I care about law and policy, but I'm also have a background in computer security. I have a bachelor's in computer science. I have a master's degree from Hopkins in computer security. I mean, I have the skills, and I've looked at DRM in some instances. I know how this works, and essentially, while the first stage is usually to monitor what's happening on the network, you would do what's called sniffing, which is seeing the packets go back and forth. On a computer, you would run a decompiler of some kind, or you would watch one program send data to another program. So the first stage is essentially monitoring. But then you need to sort of probe the system by trying information out and say, you know, if I get this signal, what do I get in response? So you need to actually... Even just to document how the system works, you need to be able to send it signals or to send it commands and see the responses you get. And the minute you start getting in that territory, you're essentially definitely engaging in reverse engineering. And when you start to try and unlock content to see if the techniques that you believe you've documented work, you've circumvented the encryption. The line is not solid, and as you get further and further down the road of documenting, the likelihood of you crossing that line just for the purpose of making sure that you have all the information that you would need later is very high.
So to the extent that this begins, once it starts to get to the point of circumvention, begins to get into the realm of reverse engineering, to what extent is this something that Congress would another computer program have to be created in order to make the works that the copies of the works that you had purchased work again? So would this fit within at least the scope of the reverse engineering exemption in Section 1201F?
So I believe that it requires more than reverse engineering.
How so?
So to reverse engineer a program that uses DRM, you need to circumvent the DRM just to figure out how it's working. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a JD. I've sat in on a couple of classes. So I don't know the ins and outs of 1201. But my understanding from dealing with lawyers in the past is that they don't view the reverse engineering exception to be very wide. And they've always told me to be very, very careful in this area. So I can't speak to the specifics of that that rule.
Well, then let's ask the lawyers.
Well, but they have no incentive to be nice to me.
So what do you think? Does it sound like the lawyers have the problem of not understanding the technology?
Right.
So we're even. But what do you think of the?
Well, I think the important thing for this proceeding is that the proponent has the burden of showing that they that their activity does not fall within the scope of an exemption that Congress enacted. Whether it's 1201F for 1201J for security testing, there might be other exceptions that would be potentially applicable here. I think it's clear from the way that this proceeding has been handled over the past decade that obviously in order to show, to make your case that you want an exemption, you have to show that your activity is prohibited by 1201A. And at 1201A1, and you can't show that if it falls within an exemption. So you have to demonstrate that your activity does not fall within the exemption, really can't be brought within the exemption. So that's the burden that the proponent would have here. And I'm learning more each day about what Chris would need to do in order to under his 10B exemption. There wasn't much about it in the submission. There's been a little more today. I certainly don't have enough facts to be able to render any opinion on it, but I think the question of the applicability of a statutory exemption is potentially a relevant one, and the relevance is that unless the proponent can show it, that can show that it it does not apply, then I think that pretty much seals the fate of that particular exemption.
If I can draw a parallel, Rob, we noted this in our comments. You know, you guys already gave Alex Halderman and Ed Felton an exemption three years ago for security testing, or for rootkits in CDs, right? And the research that they were doing to document and discover any security flaws in those DRM schemes is the same what they were going through. It's the exact same process that people would need to go through. I mean, essentially, documenting and discovering how a system works, it's the same no matter what kind of system it is, whether it's a rootkit, whether it's DRM, whether it's a security flaw, whether it's an authentication server. You know, from the perspective as a computer scientist, you go through the same process, and you all already gave that exemption to them. So, and the reason was because you felt that the reverse engineering rule was not enough in that instance, I believe.
I'd have to object to that characterization of that exemption, but I think the relevant point there is that that exemption was issued after a detailed record. There had already been an exhaustive investigation by Professors Felton and Halderman into the rootkit. That was the basis upon which the exemption was granted. So the record there showed harm to the satisfaction of the Copyright Office, and the record here clearly does not. I would like to, if I could just supplement my answer about the dongles exception, going back and looking at the text of the exception that you recognized 3 years ago, or in 2006, it only applies to obsolete dongles. And a dongle shall be considered obsolete if it is no longer manufactured or if a replacement or repair is no longer reasonably available in the commercial marketplace. So clearly, the idea that if you could go out and find a replacement dongle and get back to the status quo in the commercial marketplace if it was reasonably available, if that were the case, then the exemption would not apply.
And that was the issue, is that the sale of a reasonable price for replacement of the dongle was often not available. What was requested was the purchase price of the full program. So that the question of whether that was reasonable and that was the issue. issued to actually have to buy a high price. But
well, there's nothing in your discussion of this in the November 17th, 2006 recommendation that even, as I could see, even refers to the cost of getting the upgrade, which I think is what you're talking about. Your conclusion was, evidence was presented that damaged or malfunctioning dongles can prevent authorized access to the protected software, because in some instances the software vendors may be unresponsive or have gone out of business. The evidence painted a compelling picture of a genuine problem. So that was a problem where you couldn't get the dongle for love or money, and therefore you couldn't get back to the status quo without regard to whether you would get the upgrade. Here, you can get back to the status quo. Up till now, you've been able to get back to the status quo without any expense. But even if there were some expense, I don't think that would be a distinguishing difference.
Chris, this may be going over some ground you've already covered, but I just want to make sure I understand the case you're making here. And let's break it down. One of the things we need to determine is whether persons who are users of copyrighted works are, in other words, already have been, adversely affected by the prohibition on circumvention and their ability to make non-infringing uses. I think what I'm hearing from you, but I want to make sure, is that you're not saying that up till now people have been adversely affected, because up till now you think people have been, when these services have gone down, people have been given acceptable substitutes. Is that a fair characterization so far?
So in the instances of failed DRM services that we are aware of, that we noted in our comments, in all but one instance, refunds were given.
Okay.
And a refund is a totally appropriate and satisfactory remedy.
Okay. And the one instance, remind me again of that.
That was Walmart, and Walmart, under pressure, agreed to extend the life of its server for an undetermined period of time.
So far, no one's been adversely affected.
So far, no one has been adversely affected.
So basically, you're on the second prong, which is you're predicting that within the next 3 years it's going to happen.
I'm predicting that companies will not be in a position to offer those remedies.
Right. Now, you can't identify any particular company that you're predicting is going to be in that position. Is that correct?
I'm not telepathic, or I don't have a crystal ball. So, no. I have no idea which service will go under, but we've seen enough services go under in the last few years that I think there's a good chance that one will go under, and I think there's a very, very good chance that one will go under which doesn't have the means to provide a remedy to consumers.
So to the extent that we're trying to predict and determine, is it more likely than not that this is going to happen? I think what your case is, hard times economically, a number of services have already gone out of business. So far, they've been big enough to be able to cover the problem,
right.
But chances are that within the next 3 years, it's going to happen to some service that doesn't have the resources or the will to do the kinds of things that have been done thus far.
And I'd like to stress that if no service goes under, then the exemption won't cause anyone any harm.
Okay. Sandra and Steve, you didn't quite put it this way, but I sort of get the impression that between the lines of what you said, what you're saying about the kinds of services you've been talking about is that the consumer may think he or she has purchased a copy, but he's really just renting a copy. Is that really what it boils down to?
I don't think that's what I'm saying. I don't want to get into rental versus purchase, but I think that their rights are defined in the terms of service. So when Mr. Segoyan refers to the usage rights that they paid for, he's really talking about what's in the terms of service, and in most cases, those make it clear that their access might not be perpetual.
So whatever they're paying for, they're paying for whatever your clients are willing and able to give them, and your clients, for whatever reason, might at some point decide, sorry, whatever you paid for, you no longer have, and that's just the way the contract's written. So that's what they're stuck with. Is that basically what it is, to put it starkly?
I wouldn't put it that starkly.
I'm sure you wouldn't, but is that what it is?
No, I think that in terms of this proceeding, whether they're able to make a non-infringing use, the parameters of that are defined by the agreement that they've entered into.
They
also have other alternative ways of making the non-infringing use, but in terms of making the non-infringing use with the company that they've originally licensed with, yes, it is limited by what's in the terms of service. Now, purchase and rental obviously have a lot of other connotations, and You know, it could have tax connotations, as could obviously has connotations for other aspects of the copyright law. So I wouldn't want to get into you know, making pronouncements about how all of these services operate. It's possible that there are some services that don't, in their terms of service, spell out that the access might not be perpetual. And in that case, you might have a different situation.
Is anyone before us, any of the three of you aware of any such services where the terms of service don't limit the consumer's continued right to continue to use the works? Okay. I haven't looked at the entire record. Do we have examples, at least, in the record of terms of service?
We have some examples cited in our submission. I don't think we went to every single one.
So you are another consumer who apparently hasn't read the terms of service either.
I wonder whether Steve has signed to read the terms of service, right, when they sign up for these things. No, I don't.
Right. As I mentioned before, I'm not a lawyer, but luckily I did bring a law student with me. And I've been informed that the 1201F reverse engineering exception only applies to computer programs and not AV content, so it doesn't apply to music or movies.
Okay. And also, I think, Stephen Sanders, your position that it's really not our business, it's the FTC's business, if these terms of service don't really bring home to the consumer what he or she isn't really getting. That's nothing we should be worrying about, right?
I think that's essentially a consumer protection issue, and one that, as we've noted, they've been taking a look at in terms of the disclosures and so forth. But, you know, I think there is a valid agreement that's entered into legally.
Okay. Tell me this, then, looking at the statutory factors we're supposed to look at. If someone who was a subscriber to one of these services, which suddenly terminated the service, were to circumvent whatever access controls are on the works they've downloaded, say, in order to be able to continue to use it, what effect would that have on the market for or the value of the copyrighted works?
Well, I think the you have to be concerned about the knock-on effects here. And
I'm sorry, what effects?
Well, the effects going down the road, it wouldn't necessarily have any impact on those copies. But in terms of the willingness and interest of copyright owners and distributors to initiate these types of authentication server-based services, and with all the benefits that they bring, I would think it would make a difference. I think this was Sandra's testimony. If in fact there was permission granted by the Copyright Office, or rather by the librarian, to circumvent those access controls because they related to authentication servers, which might go out of business, that would certainly be a discouraging factor in terms of the dissemination of the works, and it would therefore have an effect on the value of the work in the marketplace. It could be that the cost to consumers would go up because we'd be back more to a binary situation in which you either have access to it or you don't. And in that case, I think the economists would say that if you're allowing access, you have to assume that it's totally unlimited access and you have to charge accordingly. The value of the authentication server, I think, as Sandra has indicated and as we tried to spell out in our submission, is that it allows for more of a spectrum for granting some rights, for even expanding the scope of those rights during the life of the relationship. And that means that people can buy what they want or what they feel they need rather than having to buy total unrestricted access to the material. So I think in the long run it would probably increase the costs, and whether that would hurt the value in the marketplace would really depend on how many people were discouraged from even entering into the transaction because the costs were much higher.
To underline what Steve was saying, I think it's not also easy to separate the so-called permanent download versus the so-called rental model in terms of if you've hacked the or circumvented the authenticating server technology, you may very well have circumvented it for all offerings. So while you may want to make the point that if somebody already has purchased, you know, permanent access to a work in their collection, that collection may also contain a number of works for which they've, you know, purchased only limited access. And when you circumvent the access control method that applies to that delivery system, you circumvent it more than likely for all types of access.
Well, that's true with any exemption we give, isn't it? I mean, if we say you can only circumvent with respect to a particular class of works, we're not giving permission to circumvent for other works as well. So if someone goes beyond the permitted class, then that's not it's not because of the exemption, and it's not lawful either, is it?
I agree. It's not lawful, and it's beyond the scope of the exemption. But in the real world, the effect is...
Well, in the real world, it's happening whether we give the exemption or not, isn't it?
Well, this is one reason why we've suggested that in this in the environment now where we're the office is making more use of descriptions or definitions of users or uses in order to define these classes, it's important, first of all, to emphasize that the exemption applies only when the sole purpose of it is to carry out the particular non-infringing mm-hmm. use that, you know, gave rise to the exemption. And also we feel to exclude the situation in which there's an effect, foreseeable effect, that it will sweep more broadly. That's a more general concern that we have about the way the exemptions are fashioned, and that would and if in the case if you felt that there was justification for an exemption in this area, we would certainly want those safeguards.
And just to complete what I started saying, in the real world, the evaluations that we make when we offer a new business model and offer different functionalities on top of that business model is a balancing between, you know, whether your exemption is intended to grant it or not, is our work going to be put at risk? And when we look at models and at technologies that are presented to us, there certainly are instances where we have elected not to license into a particular model because we feel that the work is put at too great of a risk. So it will, I would argue, diminish the availability of these sorts of, you know, additional functionalities that consumers have been looking for, and it would diminish the, you know, flexibility that we have in offering and you know, pricing works appropriately to consumers, so they're paying for just what they want and not having to pay for the full work.
Let's say that the only thing that were on the table was this exemption, but dealing only with lawfully purchased sound recordings. Now, we seem to be at a point in time now where sound recordings are now offered without DRM. That seems to be, at least at this point in time, where the industry is. So let's say you've got a service that has traditionally been offering sound recordings using these authentication servers, and you have the scenario that Chris is worried about. It goes out of business. It doesn't offer continued access. You've got these encrypted copies or protected by whatever they are on your hard drive, and they're things that are, in fact, freely available. Well, not freely available. You have to pay for them. What's the harm in letting the person who has this copy that is protected on his device strip that protection off of it when it's being offered to the general public without that protection anyway?
Well, I think I don't know the details of what Yahoo planned to do, but I do think there was some transition that they were offering for people who had previously accessed the DRM-dependent sound recordings to transition to DRM-free. So, but you're talking about a hypothetical situation in which they walk away and DRM-free versions are available in the marketplace.
Well, let's assume we agree that Chris's prediction that it's going to happen in the next 3 years. One of these services is just going to go totally out of business, not offer anything to its subscribers. And let's say it's purely a music service. That's the situation we're talking
right.
about. What's the harm in letting
I would suspect that the pricing has been different in the offer, that if you've offered a download of a non-protected work through iTunes or what have you, the pricing is higher than it is for a DRM-protected work, perhaps.
Well, iTunes was offering DRM-protected works for quite some time. Did the prices go down when they stopped offering DRM-protected works?
I believe the prices went up. There was a...
Yeah.
Was there a cause and effect relationship there?
You're paying more for an unprotected work than you do for a DRM-protected work.
And that's precisely because the protection has been removed? Is that why that happened?
Right. I mean, that's at least in theory you would say so, because you're basically enabling a lot of other uses that weren't enabled before, and those are going to displace some of the purchases that you might otherwise have had. So you would expect the prices to be higher. Whether the marketplace actually works that way, I mean, I don't know, but that's certainly what you would expect in that situation. But I think if you're asking the question, is it more in accordance with what Congress intended that people, if they in that situation, go out and buy the DRM-free tracks, or whether they'd be able to create and use a hacking tool in order to get to exactly the same point? I think I think the intention would be the former.
Well, I guess my question was, where's the harm? That's my question. Where's the harm?
I think the harm, as it is with all of these, you know, I know you asked this question in a different form on Friday as well.
I'll probably ask it tomorrow, the next day too, several
right.
times.
All I can say is that there certainly is harm that Congress was sensitive to encouraging the development and proliferation of a market in circumvention tools. And one way to prevent that was to have the prohibition on, in effect, use of those tools. I mean, I realize this doesn't match up exactly symmetrically between the tools provisions and the prohibition. Excuse me. But the idea was to limit the use of circumvention tools to two circumstances. One, those circumstances where Congress had explored the issue and struck the balance of when circumvention would be allowed, and that's, for example, in the reverse engineering area and in the other statutory exemptions. And then in the circumstance that brings you here, which is when the statutory requirements were met for showing that there actually had been a significant interference with non-infringing use. And here I don't think you would see that interference with non-infringing use. So you would see, in effect, a proliferation of circumvention tools and giving the government's imprimatur to the use of circumvention tools in a much broader range of circumstances. That, I think, would be harmful to copyright owners and to the copyright system.
And I think the other aspect of harm worth considering is that these services that offer unprotected, works for free or for, you know, whatever the pricing arrangement is, the model for each such offering is kind of negotiated in the whole and understood in the whole. So perhaps you're offering access to a work for free, but you're doing it because it's ad-supported, or you're doing it because it's, you know, surrounded by some promotional agreement that you have with the third party through which you're making the work available for free. If the consumer is able to unlock the work that they brought through a different business model, which was intended to be a protected, you know, protected download, and has no need to go to the, you know, free legal service that's ad-supported or, you know, a promotional effort or what have you, then I think that is cognizable harm. There is a business reason for negotiating that distribution arrangement, and the copyright owner is deprived of whether it's the advertising revenue or the interaction with the consumer on a new platform and the ability to, you know, expose different of its offerings to the consumer.
Yeah, I wanted to answer your question, which is that Apple just recently announced that they would have songs at different pricing tiers, something that the record companies have asked for some time. Before that happened, there was a period where there was DRM-free available. Songs are available in MP3 format with no DRM, or maybe AAC, which is Apple's system of choice, but no DRM at all for 99 cents. So there was a period in time where some labels had allowed Apple to sell content with no DRM at all, and the price was the same as it was the year before when there was DRM. And also at the same time, even while Apple was selling DRM encumbered songs, Amazon was selling stuff for the same price or sometimes less in MP3 format. So just to clarify that question of yours.
Again, those are negotiations that occur around a particular business offering, and so I can't speak to what, you know, the record labels do in terms of negotiating those deals, but I suspect that if they're anything like us, they look at all of the parameters of the offering, and they probably have a different deal with Amazon that results in a different price for that offering than they do, you know, for iTunes or, you know, whoever else is in the marketplace offering that service. The fact that the copyright owner was actually able to negotiate a higher price for the sound recordings that were made available without DRM protection recently, I think, indicates that there, you know, there are those sorts of negotiations going on, and there is a you know, a trend in the marketplace to value protected versus unprotected works differently, at least by some copyright owners.
I think it's also indicative of the fact that the hallmark of this market is experimentation. I think a lot of copyright owners are feeling their way and trying to figure out what is the best way to deliver this to consumers in a way that's profitable and that meets consumer needs. So you're going to see some shifting back and forth on this. To me, that argues for a great deal of caution in recognizing exemptions here, because you would be basically subjecting, if you had an exemption that allowed circumvention of the authentication server model, if you will, you'd be freezing that in place, at least for a 3-year period, and telling and discouraging the experimentation that's needed.
On the topic of harm, and this you know, maybe isn't as directly to the copyright owner, or not solely to the copyright owner, I should say. If you're talking about authenticating servers and particularly the sorts of functionalities that I was speaking about in my presentation, oftentimes you may have consumer financial information, you know, as part of that transaction with the authenticating server. And so there's harm to potentially a consumer if you're allowing people to circumvent and circulate tools to circumvent authenticating servers. You know, if the server is carrying financial information or other private data.
Hang on a second. So consumers are going to suffer harm because they're getting access to their own financial information? Because we're talking about a situation where the server is no longer functioning anymore, right? So there's no private information that's floating around on the internet.
You're talking also about an exemption where you're requesting the ability to create tools and circulate tools that allow you to circumvent the authenticating server that is operating.
This is the second proposal,
right.
In other words.
But I can imagine a situation in which you actually would have one consumer's financial information being put at risk by another consumer that is using a tool to gain access to work within their own home. For instance, if you one of the things that we do through Xbox is to allow consumers to access their content from different locations. So I may have purchased a movie at my home, and now I want to go to my friend's home and watch that movie. I can sign on through an authenticating server, and by use of whatever private data authenticates me to the server, I can get access to the movie that I've purchased and watch it at my friend's home. Now, if I leave and my friend has the ability to use the either the tools or has an ability to circumvent the authenticating server to gain access to that movie after I've left, they may be gaining access both to my, whether it's my credit card information that verifies me to the company or my private data that otherwise verifies me to the company.
So I do research in data breaches and privacy as well, and no company would be allowed to send credit card information back and forth as part of an authentication scheme. That would violate the PCI rules for credit card companies. I mean, what would happen would be Microsoft would keep your credit card details on file. You would pass your username back and forth or something like that. But in no instance is ever any company ever passing credit card information back and forth to authenticate some purchased work. I mean, this is not happening. So I think that's a theoretical harm, if even that. This is bogus.
Let me just move on to one other topic. I think the answer is probably no, but I just want to make sure we've covered it. Is there any reason to believe that the exemption in 1201G for encryption research might be relevant to this kind of activity?
I would think it would be relevant to 10B.
And potentially available?
Potentially available, and I think the issue is whether the proponent can demonstrate that it's not available and they can't bring their activities within it and achieve their goal.
Any comments on that, Chris?
I'm not enough of an expert.
Okay. Are we really talking about encryption here, or are we talking about something different?
we're talking about the encryption that's surrounding these services.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding is that breaking or even documenting the DRM involves more than just the encryption in some cases. That would still be considered to be DRM. So.
You might get a follow-up question.
That's fine. If you send me a follow-up question, I can sit down with lawyers and I'll do my technical stuff and they'll do the legal stuff and we can get you a better answer there.
Okay, good. All right, that's it. Thanks.
I want to ask about alternatives again. I apologize for begrudging this issue, but do you think it's useful for us to establish a uniform test for determining potential alternatives where we can look at a spectrum where it would be easy and free? And that would be an alternative versus difficult and hard for the consumer. I mean, I'm just trying to put this in some way that we can apply it in practice for not only this, but the other exemptions we have. And I just want to get your feelings on how to do that in a standardized way.
I'm not sure that I understand your question.
We're all talking about whether or not you can go to another store and get the same merchandise that you've purchased before, and then you have to go buy it again. Or you have to buy equipment to get that done, or some other way that makes it more expensive and more cumbersome to get what you had already gotten, but for the fact that if you circumvent it, you don't have to go through that expense and difficulty. So I'm just trying to establish some sort of legal paradigm by which to look at these alternatives in a objective way.
May I suggest something on that? I think if you go back and look at your previous three recommendations, you will find you've kind of developed a common law of this about what constitutes an acceptable alternative. In other words, a means of carrying out the non-infringing use that obviates the need for circumvention. It's not hard and fast, and it's stated in terms in more general terms of some of the factors you would look at. But I would think. Between that and between what's in the legislative history that you're given, that it can't be a mere inconvenience, for example, and
some of those words are so, I say, squishy that I was just trying to figure out something a little bit more concrete.
I guess I object to the premise of the proposal, really, because as we were discussing, I find it troubling that. Consumers are willing to buy, new iPods or new PCs and replace that sort of hardware every couple of years, realizing that nothing lasts forever, and that when it comes to, our efforts to enable new digital delivery models, we're supposed to ensure that the third parties to which we license works are going to remain in business forever, service the consumers appropriately forever, and if they don't, the remedy is somehow on us as the owners of the copyrighted works to provide. And I just find that troubling. I said in my testimony that we take concrete steps to ensure that the people that we license are actually standing behind the agreements that they enter into with consumers. But I think it's kind of a misplaced burden here, the way that the discussion is evolving.
I just had two quick questions, one having to do with, Chris, you're not advocating in terms of this particular, the second exemption, the ability to circumvent tools. This is to document the information that would potentially enable accomplishment of circumvention, but not distributing tools for that purpose, right?
That's correct. I'm not advocating that anyone should create tools. I'm not advocating that you guys should allow people. I don't think you have the authority to allow people to create tools, or I don't think you do, at least. No, this is solely documenting information so that if the service fails, consumers are able to then get to the works that they paid for. Just information getting for documentation purposes.
So that the documentation is preserved.
Exactly.
At that point.
Because it disappears.
Is that, I was hearing something different, I thought, Steve, from that this was somehow encouraging the creation of tools over what may exist without an exemption.
Well, I think that's really what Chris was saying up until about 90 seconds ago. What he said in his submission was the reason that they need this exemption 10B is because consumers don't have the information or technical skills necessary to circumvent a failed DRM scheme. So that you have to study, test, and document the schemes in case they fail in the future. There's a bit of a gap there, but I mean, unless you're studying, testing, and documenting these for pure research purposes, or you're doing it so that if and when the service fails, or perhaps before the service fails, so that no one will be taken by surprise, there's a tool available.
But documenting something and then later having that information available to make tools for which there would exist an action, independent action that couldn't be covered by the exemption, right, for 12182, there could be an action brought under that if someone were to make a tool, correct?
I guess the question is if the end purpose is to create a tool which is unlawful under the DMCA, then why would it be in the Copyright Office's purview to grant an exemption that allows someone to prepare to make that tool?
Well, that would be assuming the practical inability of consumers to effectuate the exemption, wouldn't it? So it would mean that the practical reality is that no one could use the exemption without the creation of a tool.
Like in every other exemption that's been given.
Okay. Well, one other question is the practical effect in the 3-year period here. If in the absence of any established harm up to date, an exemption, register were to recommend an exemption to the librarian, how wouldn't this, in effect, be a perpetual exemption? I mean, could the situation ever change after this point? Let me leave it at that.
Are you saying essentially that because there's a chance that a service would always fail in the future, that this could go forever?
Right.
I think that we're going to see more and more the remaining stores that are still doing DRM and music are going to finally give up. And so I think maybe 3 or 6 years down the road, you could restrict this solely to maybe video or solely to games. You know, that once consumers have completely ditched DRM in music, maybe the services have actually gone bankrupt, and those companies have given some remedy to consumers, all the consumers have been moved away from those old DRM schemes in music, maybe we wouldn't need that anymore. But, if services are going to go down this path of offering this business model, I think as long as companies are doing that and this risk exists to consumers, we should have this option available. And, maybe that lasts for the next 20 years if companies are following that business model for the next 20 years.
Well, we would certainly disagree that this proceeding should be in the business of discouraging this business model by imposing this perpetual or 20-year burden on it. We think this is exactly the kind of business model that Congress intended to encourage. It's given people more access to more works in more ways with more flexibility than certainly anything that existed in 1998. It's a big step forward for consumers, and we don't think that saddling it with this type of perpetual or near perpetual exemption would be appropriate.
Okay, that concludes this morning's portion of the hearing, and we will resume at 1:15, 1 hour from now. Some of us will. Mm-hmm.